Blog Talk Radio.
Sports City Chefs is in the room, cooking up hot topics to put up on your spoon. They well in tune, blown like a flower in June. Superman vs. MF Doom, the clouds loom. So tell a friend, it's the Sports City Chefs again. Pay attention, tune in, we on the set again.
Good day, everybody. I hope everybody out there is doing all right. Feeling happy and healthy. This is Dave here with Nate on the Baseball Buffet. Nate, how you doing, buddy? Nate, you there? Let's see if we can bring my boy Nate back on.
Hey,
there we
Dave,
go.
All right, we're.
I hear you.
Good to hear from you, buddy. Looking forward to another Thursday evening of baseball talk. Let's get the show on the road.
Yeah, I can't believe you know it's August. I feel like we're on the cusp of that part of the year where now that we've had one of honestly the most incredible trade deadlines that we've seen in I honestly think ever. I mean, you know, you saw a player leave Baltimore. As a Yankee fan, I saw the Yankees make two huge additions. We saw other big names. I know we covered a lot of this last week, but, you know, it really has highlighted. And I think in the end, really, we'll see this going forward, how baseball hits this shift at the beginning of August. In a way, I think this was spurred on by the – and you brought this up to me after the show, Nate, last week, but the trade deadline, it's a true trade deadline, whereas after – you know, the July 31st date, you know, there were still waiver trades that could happen. And now that's not a thing anymore. And because of that, I think we just saw so much more action. And, you know, Nate, I know you're not a big basketball guy, and we'll get to the scores in a second, but I know you're not a big basketball guy, but free agency began in basketball on Friday. And I felt like the sport of baseball was the talk of the town. It was pretty incredible. It really felt like baseball had their moment where they were finally like the opening of NFL free agency or that first just round of basketball news when you see all big trades and guys, you know, trying to facilitate crazy things. So it was really cool that the sport of baseball had such a top-notch moment for it. I know, obviously, the two of us, big baseball, lifelong baseball fans, and even some of our callers, you know, they always want to see more baseball in the headlines. So with that, I'm just going to take a quick trip around. You know, I've always wanted to call the reading the scores, you know, some fun thing. I feel like it's a trip around the base paths. Right now, we have a number of games in the books. With one of the games that happened earlier was the Mets and the Marlins, and the Marlins won that game 4-2, dropping the Mets to 56-52, still kind of controlling that NL East, but that division is going to be a very interesting one. Speaking of division leaders and good teams, we had the Red Sox play the Tigers, but the Tigers smashed in Boston, winning 53-58, that's their record, winning 8-1. And that would have been quite a score.
We could hope for a game like that one day.
Listen, they'd have to move the pitcher's mound back, 20 more feet for something like that. Detroit, by the way, is 53-58. That's why I actually saw that and I wanted to call it out. They seem like one of those random teams that could come on late in the year and really ruin somebody's day with a good series. Probably the Yankees, because that's the way the things go. But anyway, the Angels and the Rangers played in Texas, and Texas was blanked as the Angels finally moved to 55-54 to be just a tad over 500, whereas Texas still searching for their 40th win here on August 5th, which is disgusting. The Cubs and the Rockies played in Colorado, Colorado winning that game 6-5. The Giants and the D-backs with Alex Wood versus Merrill Kelly. Alex Wood, by the way, right now 9-3, and I think that's one of the successes for San Francisco. But San Francisco won that game in 10, 5-4 over Arizona. Arizona 34 wins on the season. Against San Francisco now, 69-40. So one more win, man, and San Francisco's going to get to 70 wins already. Wow. Just I guess until the season's over, I'm still going to call them a surprise. Aaron Nola and Joe Ross faced off in Washington as the Phillies beat the Nationals 7-6. Phillies increased their record to 56-53. And as I mentioned earlier, the Mets are 56-52, so that's just one more game up in the loss column, or one more game lost for Philly than the Mets. Now we have some other action going on right now. We have the Royals facing the White Sox right now. The White Sox are down 2-1. White Sox at home. Minnesota is up 4-0 over Houston. Houston. I feel like Houston is sliding a little bit, but not a lot, but I do sense some vulnerability out of Houston. Cincinnati up 7-1 against Pittsburgh. Right now, Toronto, it feels like, is up 3-0 on the Cleveland Indian Guardians, or whatever you want to call them right now. And my Yankees are tied with Seattle 2-2. Interesting note, Nate, out of New York today, Gary Sanchez goes on the COVID list along with some other Yankee pitchers, specifically Gerrit Cole. Very tough break for the Yankees. We know Gerrit Cole's James Taillon, and just the really, you know, the Yankee rotation right now is a mess. I mean, they sent Nestor Cortes to face the Mariners, and the Mariners are a good team. That's not a team that you just throw somebody up there for, but you have to, I guess, in these cases. But Nate, let's take your quick top line thoughts in the last week of baseball. Is there anything that kind of jumped out at you?
Well, let's start with what you let us off with, and that's the trade deadline. You know, we did talk about it, how Major League Baseball really did make that shift. They wanted to make it more of a true deadline, and you know, they got exactly what they wanted out of it. Like you said, everybody's talking baseball, even with the start of NBA free agency and all that other stuff. But as much time as we've spent on this show previous weeks, and you know, that it's an ongoing topic about how Major League Baseball needs to engage with the fans, how they're losing fan support, they're losing people are losing interest. What can they do to get the younger generation involved in the game? And I know I've sent you a couple of these things offline, and we've kind of touched on it here and there throughout the show, but it looks like baseball might actually be achieving their goal a little bit. You know, you brought up how baseball had their moment in the sun with their trade deadline. It was the most exciting trade deadline in a long time because everybody knew, get it done now or it's not happening. And then you add in the fact, look at the ratings that baseball has been drawing in some of these things. The All-Star Game, the Home Run Derby outdrawing the NBA All-Star Game and things of that nature. It's kind of encouraging. Is this a trend that baseball is going to go on?
Nate, you're gonna like me for this one, but it's the perfect time for your pal Rob Manfred to screw it all up.
Well, you know, that's a heck of a transition for you to roll us into, because the other just as we're getting all nice and warm and fuzzy and we start seeing the sun peek over the horizon for baseball, then we get reminded, oh wait, there's these giant storm clouds gathering over there, because I mean, MLB ownership is talking about when, not if, there's going to be a lockout to start the 2022 season. So, you know, we're going to make all this progress. We're going to have a great end to the 2021 season. The NL West race, the fight to lose the NL East. And then after all the storylines and feel-good stories of 2021 are written, then we're going to get slapped with a work stoppage at the end of the year, and everybody's going to go back to Rob Manfred.
Yeah, gosh. I mean, all right, let's stay positive. Let's stay positive. I know the names sometimes, you know, there's some names in sports that just, you know, make you think, God, this guy again. So, you know, we have been talking a lot about the popularity of baseball. And it's a very, I think, interesting time, not just for baseball, but all of sports. I mean, it's always an interesting time for all of sports, but I think right now, you know, right now, Nate, I can't say I've got it really on in any sense of like foreground, but you know, the NFL Hall of Fame game is tonight. It's probably the second worst game of the season other than the Pro Bowl. but you know what it does? It brings people to a point tomorrow where you'll wake up and say, all right, you know, here we go. And I really felt that with baseball after the trade deadline. And like you said, everybody was talking about it. They did what they needed to do. Now, I think you and I may disagree on this. I mean, I think it was great for baseball. And I mean, when you take into account everything, when you take into account the integrity of the game, does it make the sport better on the field? Does it make it better off the field? Does it, you know, when you take the impact of roster construction and being a GM, I would understand, you know, if you or somebody had said like, hey, listen, part of the game is these waiver acquisitions after the trade deadline. That's just part of what it is. Not dissimilar to, I think, when they got rid of the intentional walk, right? It's a four ball play. You throw the ball off to the side four times, right? It seemed at the time, I want to know, Nate, when they got rid of the intentional walk, what was your knee jerk reaction?
My knee jerk reaction was just to reminisce on the time that the Baltimore Orioles managed to screw it up because they called for an intentional walk. There was a game several years ago. They tried to intentionally walk
Miguel
Cabrera, and our pitcher couldn't even pull that off, and he ended up giving up.
Yeah, didn't he hit like a home run or something?
Yeah, because even when you're trying to intentionally walk the guy, we can't even throw it wide enough to get it away from the bat.
Yeah. That was an experience. But you know, at the end of the day, you really think about it, it's an intentional walk. Just send the guy to first. Like, what's the? And I hope, you know, certain of these adaptations that happen in baseball are accepted that way. Not all of them have. Like, say, the runner on second, which nobody – it's one of those ones where I was curious when we started the show, when we started the season. We were wondering, would people be – would people ever accept it? No, that's the answer. So, you know, we've talked about looking forward a lot, about the future of the sport. And right now, yeah, I mean, I know we have some people who've called in before and said they hate it when I say this, but I'm still going to do it. You know, we're certainly in some of those dog day-ish parts of summer. We're certainly, you know, we're at a part where I think, guys, if you're feeling a little more injured, you'll take a little bit more time off, especially now the way the game is played. But what I'm going to know is if you're in a locker room, I want to know, are you feeling the effects of a longer season now? I mean, this is the first time guys have played with this many games under their belt this deep into the season. So, you know, are we going to start seeing more pitcher injury? I mean, I actually thought we'd start seeing them a lot earlier, which makes me think, maybe not. Maybe these guys have done a good job in the gym, or their coaching has got them more prepared than I would have expected. Maybe my expectations were too low, but I think we're going to start to see some of the older veteran players, you know, maybe take a little bit more of a break here or there. And you mentioned a guy, you know, it's funny, you mentioned Miguel Cabrera a minute ago. I mean, that he seems like a surefire Hall of Famer, though, but, you know, he could take a little bit of a rest here or there. It always makes me wonder, Nate, and this is something you, I know you had, you know, looked at, was the future of these guys. You know, next season will be a full season. Now, Nate, I got to ask, did the 2022 schedule itself come out yet, or what's the timeline on that?
It did. The 2022 schedule dropped yesterday, actually. There are some, you know, I haven't done a deep dive or any kind of top line read for major leagues, so I don't know if there's been any read of, like, you know, games to watch early on from a national perspective. I can only tell you that I've looked at the Orioles schedule. There are some things about the Orioles schedule that definitely jump out to me, like the fact that they open April with, I think, 18 games against the AL East. So you can expect the Orioles to probably be, let's say, 5 wins at the end of the month of April for 2022. And then May, they get a nice little pocket at the beginning of May where they're playing teams that are currently 500 or worse. And then they get another pocket like that right around July. But, you know, it's always fun when they drop the next season schedule, and it doesn't look like Major League Baseball really screwed anybody too hard in terms of scheduling. Like, there's nobody that's going to spend – nobody from the East Coast has to spend 2 weeks out west playing the Padres, the Dodgers, the Giants, the Angels, and the Mariners all within a two-week stretch, anything like that. Although, I've always wanted that to be a thing. Bring back the old-school West Coast road trip where you just take the train up and down the coast and play everybody out there. I think that'd be fun. But, yeah, so we have the schedule out. Lots of stuff to look forward to.
Oh, no, I just – real quick, I just want to say I love that West Coast swing. When mm-hmm. I was a kid growing up and you knew the Yankees were going to play, you know, the A's and the Angels and the Mariners, you know, in a span of a week or 2 weeks or whatever it might have been, I love knowing, like, oh, sweet, those are the couple weeks of the year where they're going to start at 10. So I would kind of look, sort of, you know, almost adjust my day differently, and it would be more of like a – you know, not to sound too cheesy, but more of like a special thing. Whenever the Yankees would play the Dodgers, well, they didn't really play the Dodgers when I was younger because of the interleague changes, but, oh, God, that makes me sound so old. but whenever the Yankees would play the Dodgers, or I would want to listen to a Dodgers game because the Yankee game was done, you know, I just kind of put the radio on and listen to Vin Scully. But now, yeah, I don't know. The lack of West Coast swing is a little annoying.
Yeah, I mean, I do appreciate that, you know, with the ease of travel that you don't need to group everybody together, but there is something, you know, there is something magical about the old-timey feel of that stuff, where, like, hey, we're going to fly out to L.A., and we're going to have to play – well, if you're an American League team, you're going to fly out and you're going to play L.A., and then you're going to go up and you're going to play Oakland, and then you're going to go up and play Seattle, and then you can come home. So, you know, you get those 9 games over a week, week and a half, and then you come home. But what Major League Baseball has done in the last couple of years, it seems like, is like, okay, you're going to go out, you're going to play Seattle for 3, and then we're going to bring it back, and you're going to play in New York, and I'm going to fly out and make you play 3 in Kansas City, so you end up, like, jetting all over the place, and you wonder why teams go into these funks where they lose 7 to 10 games because they don't – or maybe they get to stop in at home by playing the Mets for 2 before they have to go out to Kansas City. So it looks like Major League Baseball, the schedule makers, did a much better job this year. It doesn't look like I think I read somewhere where they started doing it by computer program, or there's some set formula. They took human element
out of it.
Yeah,
it used to actually be a couple. Like, and it's exactly what it sounds like. Just 2 people would work on the baseball schedule, and they would spend almost a year on it, and they would take things like key dates. Like, for example, they would take into account – I forget if it was Ken Griffey Jr. or it might have been Ken Griffey Jr.'s last season, but they would always make sure if a team had a top-notch player that was playing the last season, they would go out of their way to make sure that For example, Derek Jeter's last at-bat was at Fenway. That never would have happened under these two folks. Again, there's a mini 30 for 30 about them called the Schedule Makers, mm-hmm. and they put emotion behind it, not just logistics. I think there's no emotion behind it. In a way, that's kind of what's hurt baseball a lot, like with analytics, right? I think there's nowhere I do analytics for a living, and there's nowhere on their spreadsheet for just the guy who has a feel for it in the bottom of the ninth, you know, with runners on, that doesn't have superb numbers. There are just some players who do better in that spot than they do outside of the regular spots, and I don't know, situationally it's not appropriate, but situationally is scheduling in a lot of ways. I mean, it's timing. That's what we're talking about, timing. So it really made me upset in a way that, like, Jeter's last game wasn't at Yankee Stadium. I think fans deserve things like that. The fact that, you know, it was done intentionally that Cal Ripken Jr.'s, you know, the record-breaking game was at home. I mean, now if they go with this computer program, you know, it's not a guarantee. If that were to happen today, which it's its own laughable thought, but if hypothetically, you know, some guy was coming up on it and would hit it in the next 2 or 3 years, you don't know. You don't know. I don't see baseball bending backwards or going out of its way to make that emotional connection with the fans. And that's one of the things that I think has hurt the sport.
Yeah, well, and, you know, you kind of touched on analytics kind of taking the soul and feel out of the game to a degree. And how they're use the example of the guy that comes up in the bottom of the ninth with runners on, and like there's no reason for him to be in that game, but he's the guy that you go to because he just has that magic touch. I think analytics, it has kind of ruined some guys' career. Now, on the whole, I think it's serving the sport better than other guys, but you can find these individual little pockets of guys that, you know, analytics has killed them, and some of these rule changes have killed them, like the new rule for relief pitchers where you have to face three batters. You now no longer have the lefty, the old acronym Loogie, one lefty, one out only guy.
Yeah.
And, you know, the Orioles, when the Orioles were good from 2012 to 2016, we had probably the Loogie of all Loogies. And you know what? I could correct that, but you look at his career, that's what he was. Like, there's no reason to sugarcoat it by calling him anything other than that term, both derogatory.
No, it's like a mercenary, basically.
Right. Well, and the guy that I'm talking about is Brian Mattis. He existed for a 4-year career. He broke up. He was supposed to be a great starter. Turns out he couldn't get his ERA under 5 or 6 as a starting pitcher. But there was one guy that he could get out, and that was David Ortiz. Nobody else can get
I knew
Poppy out,
yeah.
But Brian, Big Poppy could not hit him to save his life. And it's just astounding. You have Big Poppy, who maybe is a first ballot Hall of Famer. We'll find out in 2022. And the one guy he can't hit is a guy who probably doesn't have an MLB career, but for the fact that he played in the league the same time that Ortiz did.
Yeah. No, you know what? That's a great point. I would love that when – like the big, terrible hitter, I guess, actually, there was always David Ortiz, would come up and we'd have a specific guy that we're paying on, you know, 6 figures to go throw, you know, 5 or 6 balls and get him out. That's your life. Boy, what a life. That was it.
Right now.
Listen, do you have the right arm angle? I mean, you know, if Dontrell Willis, for instance, was like a specialist with that original wacky, you know, motion, he could have just made a career out of it, or like El Duque Hernandez. But, you know, I think I understand what they tried to do in the spirit of it, which was not just to speed it up, but I think it was just more – I could understand there's a perception where that's cheapening the pitcher versus at-bat process. I don't agree. But I know that's a take that I've read on the internet, and everything we see on the internet must be digested, right? it's been quite an adventure for the pitcher versus hitter matchup. I mean, especially look at the All-Star game, for instance. You know, I love that we can go back to the All-Star game, man. This is a really good All-Star break and a trade deadline. Yeah, man, it's so frustrating just knowing where baseball might be headed. But one of the best things about the All-Star game is just that sheer power-on-power matchup, or, I mean, every single matchup can just be the best hitter right there against one of the best pitchers every single pitch of the night. I do miss the specialists. You know, just a real quick question. I didn't intend to ask you this, Nate. How would you feel if they expanded the rosters to just keep it simple? Just every team now gets a 30-person roster. And I don't know, maybe that's a bit dramatic. I don't know. Or you could have every team gets, you know, a floating additional spot, whether it be a pitcher or batter. I think that's what they do in the double headers now. The roster expanded 26 on those days. I think there's got to be a way to
combat roster. They actually expanded the rosters last year for COVID, and
they left
the expanded roster now. But you are correct that on doubleheaders, you do get one extra guy that can come up off the minors for that one game. Nine times out of ten, it's a pitcher, just because you figure you're throwing a guy either on short rest or you're throwing a guy on, you know, out of turn in the rotation, so you figure you're going to be going to the pen earlier. But in terms of how I would feel about you know, expanding rosters a little bit further,
with keep in mind with the backdrop that the purpose is to, like, you'd have to keep, it's not fair, but you'd have to keep. I basically would have to be like a pitching situation. I don't know how you'd regulate it, but just for the spirit of the conversation, if it was, you know, you can have 10 you can have 10 position players, you name, you know, three backups, and then your pitching staff is your starter, and then you name an XYZ set of, I'm kind of almost like creating like lines like you have in hockey, but for a game by game basis. But what I'm saying is you'd have more pitchers available, because I think some teams load up on pitchers and leave next to no bench, and it seems like that's more and more common. But if you load up on more pitchers, then you can have more matchup type situations. I'm trying to get back to that.
Yeah, you know, I think I like the idea of an expanded roster, but I like it more so to have more bench hitter options, weirdly, than pitcher options. So, again, you always fall back on what you know, and I know that the Orioles, we've been carrying 13 or 14 pitchers all year. Now, that's necessitated because we don't have any pitching. We have 14 guys, and all of them are terrible. But
hey, we're doing the same thing.
You know, yeah. But basically, the Orioles, like, we came out of spring training, and Brandon Hyde, the manager of the Orioles, is basically saying, like, yeah, I'm going to go with a three-man bench, which, you know, one of those guys on the bench is going to be your catcher. You basically get a utility infielder, and then you get a fourth outfielder, and after you're done with that, it's like, okay, everybody else in the bullpen. And it's really left the Orioles kind of in really tough spots a couple of times this year because – you know, a guy gets hurt, but he's not hurt enough that you put him on the 10-day DL, so he's just kind of there, but he can't use him. So now you're stuck using a suboptimal backup guy. Like, you know, it also doesn't help that the entire Oriole infield is basically utility players between Ramon Urias, Pat Valaika. Until today, Pat Valaika was designated for assignment today, and the Orioles picked up a guy that the Padres designated for assignment to replace him, the former top 100 prospect, Jorge Mateo, who is basically a cheetah in baseball spikes. But there's been a couple of times where I definitely think that there could be teams that could benefit from it, even if you just get the extra bench hitter so that you have a third catcher.
What if you designate know how in football you have like the emergency quarterback? What if you did something similar with like an emergency catcher? Anyway, keep going. I love where you're going with this.
Yeah, well, and I mean that actually the emergency catcher is a role. Like there are guys on every team that are designated as the emergency catcher, but I know that don't take up the roster spot, is what I'm saying, though. Right, yeah, you're basically taking, I think for the Orioles a couple years ago, the guy was Ryan Flaherty because he literally played all over the field. So it's like, okay, well, our starting catcher has to come out because we pinch hit for him in the ninth inning. The backup catcher just got hurt, so now we got to bring in who's going to catch the rest of the game. It's like, hey, Flaherty, throw on the gear kind of thing. So, like, you know, having that because – and it also with the DH rule – is currently in place, especially in the American League. You know, you have some teams, let's go with the Yankees. I can't remember who your backup catcher is behind Gary Sanchez off the top of my head. Who's catching for you guys tonight?
Well, catching for us tonight is Kyle Higashioka, who's a very good catcher, but then they had to call up, you know, Brantley. His name is Rob Brantley, you know, a 32-year-old catcher who's, you know, he was a third-round pick in 2010, you know, kind of never really, you know, had much of a career. But, yeah, that's kind of where you are now.
Right. But so, like, a couple of years ago, back before we found out that he wasn't very good, the Orioles had Chance Sisko as catcher, and you also had Caleb Joseph, who was doing okay. Pedro Severino, he can hit, but he can't really catch. And you've had these catchers, and there are teams that, you know, maybe they have two catchers that can hit. One of them's a better defensive guy, but you don't want to take their bat out of the lineup. So let's use the Yankees as that example. Say, hypothetically, Gary Sanchez isn't on the COVID list and you wanted to give him a rest from behind the plate. Well, you want to keep his bat in the lineup, so you put him at DH. Well, here's the problem. If Higashioka gets hurt or gets pinched hit, gets lifted and pinch hit for, and you have to move Gary Sanchez behind the plate, well, now you lose your DH. Now your pitcher has to hit. So, you know, if you could expand the rosters a little bit to have that third catcher or the emergency catcher so you don't risk losing the DH, I'd be in favor of that. It's a way to keep the offense up and not
I like that.
Make anybody suffer. And you still can, if you want to run with a deep bullpen to get more matchup guys in there, you can do that too.
And see, that's the thing. Once you can't upset the delicate balance of a roster. I think maybe I'm just way too sensitive to that. I think, like, messing with roster construction is rude. It's what the GMs do. I get that they are also paid to adjust on the fly, but damn it, they spend all this time to build a roster and then you change the rules. Then when they did that reliever has to stay in for three innings thing, I was not a big fan. I'm still not a huge fan. Like we said, it eliminates that magic of the one-on-one matchups. So,
I really think it ends up hurting the game. Like, let's look at last night's Oriole-Yankee game, for example. The Orioles made a pitching change in the seventh inning. It was a 3-3 game. We let the guy who was on the mound start the seventh inning. He walked the first guy he faced. Paul Fry comes in. Paul Fry, usually one of our shutdown relievers, he walks a guy, clearly has no control, but they had to leave him in there to face three batters. By the end of the inning, the Orioles were down, I think it was 7-3, and they ended up losing the game 10-3. So it went from, like, a good, winnable game to now this three-batter rule. We can't lift the guy that clearly doesn't have it, and the game got away from him.
Yeah, by the way, in that game, did you see that throw from Judge?
Oh, that was beautiful. Absolutely
but
gorgeous.
The thing that blew my mind about it was so effortless. But anyway, yeah. I don't want to sit here swooning over a throw from outfield, but yes, I do. Every time I see a good outfield play, I'm like, these kids don't understand how good Andrew Jones was in center field, though. Do I miss that. Every night it felt like he's Superman and went after some fly ball. I feel like you don't see that much anymore. Torrey Hunter.
You're going to needle me a little bit here because you bring up this gorgeous play from Judge in right field to cut down Cedric Mullins stretching for a double, and you have to contrast that with the guy that the Orioles decided to throw out in right field, DJ Stewart, who I'm pretty sure an elephant in ice skates has more dexterity.
That's good.
An
elephant
right
in ice skates. Wow, that's elegant, man. Just real quick. There was a guy. It was one of my college roommates. He was a huge Phillies fan, and I graduated in 09, so he was a Phillies fan. It was 09. He just had the time of his life. But he would always say Jim Thome used to run like he had a refrigerator on his back, and I just always loved that line. But I like Elephant on Ice Skates. I might make that part of the rotation.
There's that one. I can throw another one out at you. I'm gonna borrow from a friend of mine that I watch English soccer with. There used to be a guy. He was a defender for the club that we watch, Liverpool, and he was a guy that he could be good, but you never knew what was going to happen to him. And the best way that we ever heard him described is he was a piano at the top of a hill. Eventually, that thing's going to come rolling down, and you just want to be out of the way. But you have no idea when it's going to let loose.
A piano at the
top of a hill.
That's a new one. All right, Nate, I got a question for you. Speaking of pianos at the top of the hill and guys like Jim Thome, and I know we talked about Miguel Cabrera, I've been dying to ask you this, and this is just one of those dog day questions. And Nate, as we continue to do the show, and anybody who listens, I think you'll know I'm pretty honest about things and my love for the sport. I love historical context. So I want to ask, of the players right now, who do you think are the most surefire Hall of Famers, just without thinking, just give me like two names that just jump off of your head. Try to cap it at three, but like the first two that jump into your head, and a pitcher and a hitter.
Okay, pitcher and hitter. I'm going to not go Mike Trout because that's way too obvious. Going to go.
I appreciate that.
Justin Verlander for the pitcher, and I'll go Mookie Betts for the hitter, because hitter non Mike Trout category. I think Miguel Cabrera also definitely is Hall of Fame bound, but for the sake of guys that aren't near the end of their career, talking guys that are like kind of in the middle of the prime, the surefire Hall of Famers for the hitters, I'm going to go Mookie Betts.
Okay. I was thinking with a pitcher, I like Verlander. He's really had quite an up and down career too. He's done it in multiple places too. I think that's one thing, I still think of him in my kind of memory of as a Tiger, more than an Astro, which I think is pretty fun. And then a hitter, man, how dare you pick Mookie Betts? I don't know. I'm not over him being a Red Sox. Just taking up, like, hasn't washed that stink off me just yet. But in terms of a hitter, I don't know. I feel like that's a lot harder in a way. I guess Miguel Cabrera was my answer, honestly. That was kind of where I was going with that. And that was why I was excited about that, because Miguel Cabrera and Albert Pujols, like, let's just pretend that they were kind of on the same team and in a similar situation. I could understand if LA would have kind of cut bait with a guy like a Miguel Cabrera, at least tried to get something out of him. I think if you want to, I want to ask you the same question though, Nate, but with the backdrop of under the age of 30 that you think would be a Hall of Famer. And again, let's leave on an active roster right now. Just put a little fun asterisk on the question.
I mean, there's some guys that you just like look at and you expect them to be really good, but it's still so early, because you could throw Fernando Tatis in there, you can throw Vlad Jr. in there. I like Trey Turner, weirdly, in this category, although I think he's got a lot of work to do, but I could see him sneaking in if we're going like real young guys. Or, I hesitate to to throw out a guy like a Mancini or a Mountcastle because they have a lot to do to get into that conversation. Yeah, man, that's tough if we're going to go like under 30 because there are some guys, because another name that I was going to throw out for hitters that are getting towards the end of their career that, you know, somehow we just glossed over is Yadi Molina and Buster Posey.
Good which, call. I like Yadi in that one, especially just the longevity.
Yeah.
I think Andrew McCutchen is still active.
You know he is, but I don't see it. I don't like.
Really?
I loved Kutch when he was in Pittsburgh. I just don't know that he did. I don't know that he's done enough. Like, I don't think he performed at high enough a peak for a long enough stretch. Like, you think Hall of Famers and these guys, like, the average MLB player probably is going to have peak performance for, like, 3 to 5 years, and your Hall of Fame guys, their peak is stretching for, like, 6,
don't
7,
make me
eight
go
years
look up
sometimes.
Some Sandy Koufax statistics. Ooh, I
yeah,
got one
okay.
for you. Where, do you think Manny Machado
yeah.
seems like he's on a path?
Yes, Manny Machado definitely
he,
is on the
that
path.
That move
now, he's
turned
got, he's
that
got
franchise around.
Yeah, and if San Diego can pull it off and they can win,
oh yeah,
I think Manny, and especially if Tatis ends up missing significant time here down the stretch because he's got a torn or partially torn labrum in that shoulder. Affecting his play, if he ends up having to miss, say, most of the month of August or, like, decent amount of time in September, Manny Machado sneaks in there for an MVP award, and then the Padres end up capturing that World Series, I think that could really be a big feather in Machado's cap. And Bryce Harper, I don't know. Maybe not.
So,
I think he kind of moved into oblivion going out to Philly.
You're not wrong. I actually weirdly agree with you. And I remember when I loved and did a little bit more in high school. I loved like seeing who was the best player in high school, the top, you know, 10, 15, 20 players coming out of high school every year. Mm-hmm. And I remember when Bryce Harper was training at the Trop and he was just hitting bombs at the Trop when he was like, you know, 16 or something crazy like that. But now I cheated a little bit here on something. So I'm going to kind of turn this into a little bit of a trivia. I have on my screen the list of active home run records, the active home run hitters. Now, there's one guy over 500, and you know who it is. And we, I think, intentionally skipped his name because it's too easy, and that was Pujols. Now, after Pujols, there are two guys with 400 or more home runs. Who are they?
Cabrera.
You should get this. Yep.
And Nelson Cruz.
Yep, and Cabrera is at 498, so he's two away. I was wondering if, I remember, I think he hit like two or three in a night the other day, and he's kind of sat on it. And then the next guy on the list, so it goes 675 for Pujols, 498 for Cabrera, 438 for Cruz, and then there's a big drop-off to 334 home runs. It's almost 100, that's over 100 home run difference between the third and fourth active player. Who is it? I'll give you a hint. He's the highest lefty on the list, too. Wow, what a drop. And they're all a year in difference. So Nelson Cruz has been playing for 17 years, and he's 40 years old. This guy I'm talking about, he's been playing for 16 years, and he's 38. So he's got a lot of experience under him.
So I'm going to admit that I just pulled it up myself. Sorry to ruin your game. But it's actually interesting you bring this up because I was kind of having this discussion with some friends earlier today, and the guy you're talking about is Robbie Cano.
Absolutely.
And so here's the thing with Robbie Cano and Nelson Cruz that I actually – throughout the idea, could Robbie Cano be a future Hall of Famer because of what you
not
point out? Like he is, I agree with you, but I'm curious as to why you say not a chance.
I mean, the guy was suspended for a year.
That's exactly why. Yeah, that's exactly why I'm in agreement. I think if you look at just his stats, though, his career war is actually – his overall career war is, like, right at or above Miguel Cabrera's career war, I believe. Or, like, they're very, very close. I need to check that – I need to check it to be sure. But they are very close in career war. So, it's like, statistically, Robbie Cano has an argument, and he's at a much easier position to get into the Hall, whereas Miguel Cabrera, you know, he started as third baseman, and he's now primarily a DH first baseman. That's a really hard – position to crack into the Hall in, but Cano got popped not once, twice. And like you say, he missed an entire season. But here's the thing. Nelson Cruz also was suspended for PEDs, but everybody just kind of gives him a pass. And everybody gives David Ortiz a pass. Exactly. Everybody just kind of forgets that David Ortiz and Nelson Cruz were also
Oh, I don't forget about David Ortiz, damn it. I'm a Yankee fan.
Right, but like Nelly Cruz, like for some reason he gets a pass, and David Ortiz looks like he's going to get a pass, and they're going to elect him into the Hall of Fame as a pure DH, and it's kind of a little annoying to me in the regard. I mean, to Cruz's credit, he hasn't gotten suspended a second time, so he kind of allows everybody to forget that he did get caught that one time. And also, to be fair, he never technically tested positive. He was convicted via paper trail when the whole not Balco. What was the lab down in Florida that the second big rash that got everybody caught up?
Oh, I thought that was the. Oh, was this the one with the A-Rod's trainer?
Yes, yeah, that one.
Oh man, I think it was Rodrigo Garduno. I had to look it up, but I know what you're talking about.
Yeah. So, but here's the thing, like Nelson Cruz, he's just kind of like, he's right now playing this ageless wonder, but you know, keeping in the back of your mind, where's the fall off? The fall off has to happen. He just isn't falling off. Like it raises a question for me. And I don't know. My take on Hall of Fame and the PED usage thing is kind of like, I'm willing to draw a bright line in the sand right around 2011. So the guys, Barry Bonds, Roger Clemens, I guess Mike Piazza, he did go into the Hall, but he's in that group. Andy Pettit, you know, these guys that Barry Bonds is the headliner of the group, but you know, these guys that, Mark McGwire, Sammy Sosa, those types, those guys that are implicated, never technically tested positive. I'm willing to let them in because PED use was so rampant in the sport. How much of an actual advantage were they really gaining when the pitchers were also using it? But when the clampdown happened, if you get popped post 2011, Robinson Cano, David Ortiz, Nelly Cruz, I have no sympathy for you anymore after that point.
So,
and like you can even and you can even do like an asterisk if you really need to, since everybody loves to throw those on there.
I love the asterisk thing. I tell the story. I'm always, and I know it's something we talked about at the top of the season, but I always say put guys in the Hall of Fame. It's a museum. Your job is to tell the story of baseball. Now, Nate, I think I've told you we often, I think you do as well, if I go reference stats, I go to baseballreference.com, and their kind of paid version is StatHead, which covers all sports, and I do have a StatHead.com subscription. It's a great subscription. If anybody is interested, I highly recommend you do it. This is not a paid advertisement. It's just something I really like, and one of the things you can do on StatHead is you can get a player's career statistics from a certain point to a certain point. So I did anybody's career starting in 2011 through today. And the home run leader from starting in the 2011 season, unsurprisingly, is the guy we've been talking about, Nelson Cruz with .361. Second on that is Edwin Encarnacion. And third is Mike Trout, and then Stanton, and then Pujols. So there's your top five. Cruz, Encarnacion, Trout, and Stanton. By the way, I mean, Edwin Encarnacion, it kind of actually surprised me a little bit, but at the same time, didn't. I just thought that was a very interesting observation on there. Now, the first guy on the list who hadn't been playing since 2011 is Nolan Arenado, who began his career in 2013. So he's also a guy that truly, in your, in sort of your vacuum that you've made, and I've helped statize it, I kind of fits that mold. So now, you know, by the way, I have a really quick laugh for a moment. I did a double take because number 11 on the list, tied with Arenado, was Chris Davis, and I was like, wait, and I'm like, oh yeah, the other Chris Davis.
K-Ris? K-H-R?
C-H-R-I-S Davis.
My good friend, Senior Backache.
Here's a fun one. I'm fine. Now that you've put me into this hole, I've decided to sort by batting average. If you go with a career since 2011, there are only 9 guys that have batting averages over 300, and one of them is Trey Turner. Another one is Buster Posey, which I find very odd. The leader in the clubhouse right now, by the way, are Cabrera and that tiny little jerk, Jose Altuve. And as a short person, I should like Altuve, but I just don't.
We can just bang on trash cans until he goes away.
Yeah. Listen. I'm glad people haven't forgotten, but man, am I disappointed. If one of the, you know, I say this in a lighthearted sense, one of the things that COVID took away from us was the opportunity to just tell that little jerk how we really feel. If you can't tell, I'm very fired up about that. So Nate, all right, I want to make sure I give this fair time because we've teased it for a while. And I want to take this to our close. Nate, the single weirdest idea I've ever heard you have, I want you to go for it. The floor is yours. Explain it, and then explain what you want to do, how it would work, and why the hell you're suggesting it.
Okay. So the idea I'm throwing out here that I'm eventually going to type this up so everybody can read it in case you missed it here while we're talking about it on air. We reformat MLB, Major League Baseball, to introduce promotion relegation. It's been an idea that other writers and pundits have kicked around, but the idea has always been kind of half-hearted, and it's like, well, you know, the Orioles are so bad. Maybe they should be playing AAA ball. That's not where I'm going with this. I don't want to get the minor leagues involved at all.
Okay.
I say you split – there's 30 major league teams right now. I say you split them in half. The top 15 are the first division, the second – or the, you know – senior, we'll call it National League because the National League is the older league. So the top 15 teams go to National League. The bottom 15 teams go to the American League.
So an overhaul, a realignment, right?
Right. It would be a complete overhaul and realignment. Of those 15 that are in the top and the 15 that are in the bottom, they would be then further delineated into 3 divisions of 5 geographically. So when I wrote this up, I think it was like 2 weeks ago, 3 weeks ago that I first broke it down. I'm going off the standings as of that time.
Okay.
So the bottom division, the American League, in the North, I would have Philadelphia, the Cubs, Detroit, Pittsburgh, and Colorado. In the South, you would have Atlanta, Baltimore, Washington, Miami, Arizona. And then out West, you would have St. Louis, the Angels, Minnesota, Kansas City, and Texas.
Oh, don't make me buy into this, Nate.
Okay, well, hang on. As part of this realignment, we're also shaking up the schedule. So now you're playing 60 games. You would play 48 games within your 5-team division. You would play 60 games, which is a home and home against the other 10 teams in the division. And then you would also get 6 games against first division team. So, you know, at the time that I broke this out, the Yankees were above that 15 mark. So the Orioles would play maybe 6 games against the Yankees. You don't play everybody in the top division. You just get, you know, randomly 6 games against some matchup up there. So So they all told the season only accounts for 114 games. From April 1st to Memorial Day, you are only playing games Friday, Saturday, Sunday. There are no weekday baseball games while school is in session. From Memorial Day through Labor Day, you play every day of the week. And then from Labor Day to the end of the season, I think I calculated it out, the end of the season would fall around September 25th. You're only playing weekend games again. Because I actually looked at attendance figures. Teams aren't even drawing really 10,000 fans right now to weekday games, but they're drawing 20 to 30,000 on the weekend. So you're maximizing your attendance figures that way. Now, the fun part, the division, so if we're looking at the bottom 15 teams, the three division winners automatically get promoted up to the Division I for the next year. The three teams that lose their division on the top level automatically get relegated down to the second level. And then you take, so you got the next four teams at the top level and the next four teams. So you have three division winners get moved up, and then the next four teams in order. So it's kind of like a wild card situation. Those four teams go into a playoff to determine who's going to be the fourth team coming up. And you do the same thing to drop back down from the top level. So you got the three division losers automatically drop, and then the next four worst teams play a little playoff to determine who's going to go down with them. And then for championship playoffs, you take the three top division winners plus one wild card. So you basically have three sets of playoffs, one to determine your World Series champion, one to determine who's dropping from the first division to the second division, and one to figure out who's going from the second division up to the first division.
Okay, now, real quick. How do you feel – I was ready to just go nuts on you. I like where you're starting with this. The thing I have the most of an issue with is the scheduling, and I think that's I hope you see that as a victory, that's the one thing I've got issue with. But I have a question. How do you feel about the play-in tournament in the NBA? I know you don't even really watch it too much. It's very technical what you've come up with, and I dig that, you know. But how do you feel about the play-in tournament in basketball to determine the bottom two seeds in the playoffs? Or the bottom seeds?
I kind of dig it, because what it reminds me of is European soccer in a way, and that's kind of where I patterned my proposal off of, which is where ProRel I kind of pull it from. It's the idea that, you know, okay, you didn't win, but you still have something to play for, and anything can happen when you get into the end. It's kind of where Major League Baseball went when they came up with this one game wild card idea that I don't know that it really was great, but they wanted to recreate the magic of the But they, you know, they did it because they wanted to recreate the magic of the game 162 in 2011, where the Yankees and the Rays were both fighting for that.
Great.
Yeah, they were both fighting for that last spot, and the Red Sox had the spot, but then the Orioles knocked them out, and everybody was like playing all at the same. And like, you're literally scoreboard watching four different games to figure out who was going to make the playoffs and who wasn't. And that's where the one-game wild card with baseball came from, is to recreate that drama of the thing. And that's why I kind of like that, and I like the idea of it with the NBA playing game to then get into the playoffs.
Yeah. That's interesting, mate.
Obviously, very green, but I think it could work, but it definitely would need tweaking.
Yeah.
And there's
I'm excited to see your article about it.
Yeah, and there's no chance it'll ever happen, because it would require the owners dropping 50 games of revenue off their books. And if they're not willing to place 80 games in a pandemic season, why would they play 114 when they could play 162?
There you go. All right, Nate, that's good stuff. We are up against it here. I want to just remind everybody, Nate's going to post a cool article about this so you can see all the technical intricacies. Check us out, www.sportcitychefs.com. Check us out on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram. We've got tons of new stuff up there. Big shout-out to Barry, TP, Everybody out there, you guys have all been doing great stuff. Everybody out there, you have a good night. I've said enough for a lifetime, and for the last time, I wish you all a very pleasant good afternoon.